something happening here. But what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
This is Comics Therapy, episode 26. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, we're foregoing our usual routine and talking instead about Image Expo. And on the couch, we chatted with Eisner-nominated writer Brian Wood. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers from here on out.
Greetings, comic therapists. This is Roderick Ruth here at Roderick Ruth on Twitter, sending in for this week's nerd confession about best con experience. I've had a ton of great con experiences, and here are some of my highlights. So my first convention was, in fact, San Diego Comic-Con back in 2011. I used to be an avid comic book reader off spinner racks in my youth, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, and after being overstimulated from the 90s, I retreated away from comics and mainly stuck to graphic novels and trades that I'd get from Barnes & Noble and Borders. So one day a coworker of mine was like, hey, you're into comics, let's try to go to a Comic-Con, I hear they're a blast. You know, I had a friend in San Diego that would put me up, and I said, sure, let's do it. So after enduring the grueling process online, we managed to get badges by the skin of our teeth, and I remember when I finally got to the Comic-Con, it was absolutely insane. So many nerds, so many geeks, so many things I love were just all sort of happening all at once, and I remember being on the exhibition floor just sort of standing there and taking it all in. So I'm in the middle of the exhibition floor and I look up at the enormous wall at the Marvel booth, and I'm seeing a giant display of Spider-Man and all these characters with spider powers, and saying, what the hell? How did Shang-Chi and Captain America get spider powers? What's this Spider Island crap? What the hell is that? So I had to find out. And this was right around when the New 52 was happening, so those two moments combined sort of got me all back into monthlies all over again. So I had to go next year. So my second great experience was the following year at San Diego Comic-Con. This year I was all about going to panels, and I remember the docket for one of the rooms was a bunch of DC panels and Marvel panels going on back to back. Usually that never happens. They usually break it up with something that's just not going to pique your interest. But this year, you know, it was a solid probably 3 or 4 hours of stuff I was interested in. So I ended up going solo and waiting in line and sitting with a whole bunch of people, and we all stuck through the same panel for about 4 or 5 hours together. It was great. Met a lot of people. We had bonded and made friends with one of them, and I still talk to him to this day, so that was pretty cool. This was also when the DC panel had Court of Owls, and they were passing out the free owl masks, so, you know, Scott Snyder could take pictures of everyone wearing the owl masks, and it was pretty creepy, and it was cool to be a part of, and it was fun. Third great comic experience was also this past year at New York Comic Con, where I blitzed through the doors on opening day, and I tried to get a limited edition of Walter White for the Breaking Bad figure, and little to my surprise, they were sold out. So I go over to the Image booth to check out signings and wait in line to meet Greg Rucka, and next thing I know, the Hangouts, Jessica Boyd and Allison Berry, are waiting in line behind me, and I'm like, hey, I know you girls, and we proceed to mildly geek out about stuff in the con experience. So overall, cons are great. I recommend fans go at least once or for a day to experience it. I plan my vacations around them, so do it. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. This week, no reviews, but no analysis either. Just conversation. And for what it's worth, we think it's a pretty great one. We had a candid discussion with Brian Wood about his writing process, work-life balance, and thoughts on the comics industry as a whole, and we really want you to hear it. But we also want you to hear, at least briefly, about our adventures together at Image Expo. Spoiler alert, there were no fatalities. We promise we'll get back to our regular comics analysis routine next week. Maybe even with some grief counseling.
Yeah, maybe. In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, celebrating the geeky things we all do, say, read, and enjoy. This week's prompt asks listeners to share their best or worst con experiences. You can call, Skype, or email your confessions. All the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. We're posting the weekly theme on the site, on Twitter, and on Facebook for your convenience, but the rest is up to you.
My husband works for a small publisher, and I was doing art card sketch commissions for a few dollars a piece while he worked at the table. There was very little traffic at all. It was a tiny con in a suburban shopping mall. One young guy comes by, looks at my samples, and asks if I'll do adult sketches, adding, "I promise I'm 18. After checking his ID, I tentatively said, "Sure. How bad could it be if you wanted it on an art card, right?" At which point he describes, complete with illustrative hand gestures and emphatic facial expressions, the following scenario. Mary Jane, with giant breasts and a tiny little Spider-Man bikini top, simultaneously jerking off two guys, one of whom is really fat. This was important somehow. And they're ejaculating all over her while a third guy penetrates her. This is the point at which I should probably share that this wasn't his first suggestion. His first suggestion actually detailed him having sex with either Black Widow or Mary Jane, him, with his face. I had to politely explain that I wasn't that great with actual facial likenesses. So after he describes this in detailed gangbang, I politely excused myself, took my husband aside, and explained to him what he was asking. I guess I was maybe hoping for a little machismo. This guy's a whack job. Maybe you shouldn't engage the crazy, pep talk. What I got instead was, geez, that's a lot to sit on an art card. To date, not the finest example of my work.
And in between shows, you can find me on Twitter, at Andrea Schock, and Aaron, at Aaron Myers. And of course, the show account, at Comics Therapy. So Aaron, how was your week? Did you do anything special?
I got a bunch of comics in the mail. I don't know.
Sounds pretty standard.
Yeah, well, I got to see my brother and my sister-in-law. And
hey, don't
my niece.
They live down in San Francisco, right?
Well, they live in Berkeley.
Well, you know, they live in the Bay Area.
That's true, yeah.
Huh.
So I did some other stuff when I was down there. I don't know, nothing interesting.
Right.
How about you?
Did you see anybody else when you were there?
Nobody that's, like, worth mentioning. Nobody would know.
Right. Yeah.
There was a lot of double negatives there.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, you're a dick.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So, do you hate me more now that we've met or less?
I was going to actually open with that one for you.
Oh, you were at the top.
I was at the top of what? List of people that you hate? What? What do you mean?
You were at the top of the list.
Of?
Things.
Fun things that are fun.
No.
Okay.
I had a great time. It was a very long day.
It was a very long day. Well, especially for you, because you flew down from Eugene by way of Istanbul.
Yes, not Constantinople.
Right. Well played.
I thought it was fun. I had a fun day with you.
We should actually say that what we're talking about, of course, is Image Expo, which was last Thursday, January 9th. And held here in San Francisco. Aaron came down from Eugene, Oregon for all of the festivities. And it was pretty festive, not going to lie. Long day of comics.
I have several thoughts on it.
You have several thoughts?
Yes. So if anyone doesn't know, Andrea and I had never met before in real life. We were just Twitter friends who decided to do a podcast together.
I'm worried about what you're going to say now.
No. And so this was our first time meeting, and I don't know, personally, it didn't really matter, and if take that the right way.
Okay, I'm taking it the right way. Keep going.
You know what I mean? Like, to where it's like, I didn't feel like, oh, this is a stranger I'm meeting. We were just hanging out as friends, like we do on the internet.
Aw, that's adorable. Do people do that on the internet? That sounds creepy.
Hang out?
Yeah.
I don't know, like at cons for sure. Like there are people that, at least regionally, that I've met, you know, at cons, like Jason Sachs, who runs Comics Bulletin. Like, we've met at cons, and you know, that's where I met Jason, but it's been several times now.
Did you meet Jason at the con first, or did you talk to him on the internet first?
No, we talked on the internet first. Okay. I wrote some stuff for Comics Bulletin. And
I think that's becoming increasingly more common in terms of at least the comics community, just because of Twitter, right? I mean, it just seems like such a no-brainer.
Right. So most of the people, you know, comics friends, quote-unquote, are all people I met on Twitter and then have, had reason or opportunity to meet in real life.
And sometimes they're me, and sometimes they're adorable.
Yes, that's not always the case. They're not mutually exclusive, necessarily.
Right.
But yes, those were two separate statements that I would agree with. So, I don't know, that part was fine. We had a confusion at the airport, but traveling is confusing sometimes.
It's not, actually. Here's a question. Just play along. If one were to arrive at an airport, one would go to the arrivals to get picked up, right? As opposed to arriving at the airport and then going to the departures. That seems like, I don't know, not like kind of the way that you do it.
If it was an airport that I flew into on a frequent basis, I would understand that it had multiple levels.
It's not a matter of the airport. It's just your grasp of language. Arrivals. That's where you arrived at. That's where you're going to go to get picked up, as opposed to departures. Did your brother drop you off at the airport on Friday?
Yeah, I was departing from the airport.
Uh-huh. Part of that, don't you understand? Did you take you to the arrivals when you departed?
I didn't pay attention. I was too busy saying goodbye to my beloved family member.
Right. Well, I had plenty of time to sit there wondering where the hell you were.
Mm-hmm.
It was fine.
Good for you.
Uh-huh. Hi, Aaron. Hi, Andrea. It's Jason Sachs. How are you doing today? I'm at Jason Sachs on the Twitter. Best condition experience is a little bit of an origin story for me. My first out-of-town convention, meaning not in Seattle, was WonderCon 2008. It happened to be on my birthday, February 24th, 2008, which I remember distinctly because I got special permission from my wife to make a special trip down to San Francisco. Went to the convention without having any plans whatsoever to do anything other than go have a good time and make the best of it. What turned out was just an amazing experience, a chance to spend a lot of time with some fantastic creators, Tony DiZuniga, Tom Yates, Steve Englehart, and I talked for an hour about Silver and Bronze Age Marvel comics. It was just full of amazing experiences, really, which was just kind of unencumbered by the fact that I really had no agenda, no plan to buy things, etc. And instead, I ended up meeting easily 2 or 3 dozen people who are still friends, actually. And the highlight of the trip was a dinner that my friend Derek McCullough, the graphic novelist, had, in which about 2 dozen people showed up. Many of whom are still friends, led to a crazy drunken night of debauchery and wildness at dive clubs in San Francisco. And lo and behold, this whole kind of experimental one-off experience of going to an out-of-town convention ended up becoming kind of a lifestyle choice because it was just so amazing. From that experience, I've kind of started to kind of be a preacher of conventions, telling people, you got to get out of town. Have the experience of going somewhere else. Get away from the wife and kids for a weekend, or the husband and kids, and get a little loose because it's an amazing time. So that's my con experience. Thanks. Talk to you later.
So Image Expo, I have a couple of things to say about that.
Okay.
It's very surreal to be part of, and this is not bragging, but I would say it's fair enough for us to say we are part of the inner circle at the convention.
No. I'm going to stop you right there.
Why not?
I know what you're going to say. I just don't like the way you're framing it.
It's okay. It's not saying like, oh, we got to do something. We were there as press for Comicosity.
Okay.
And we got to be in the press area with all the people that were on stage.
Right.
That is different than being a person who buys a ticket to be part of the event and get signings and that sort of thing.
Agreed.
It's a different experience.
It's a different experience. It's not an inner circle experience. It was very accessible in terms of media access. That's all.
Sure. Yeah. But at the same time, how many media people were there? In the back room doing interviews like we were.
But I think that speaks to when the event was held and where the event was held.
Sure. At the same time, if we're standing in a hallway with Rick Remender and Robert Kirkman, I think that's a pretty special experience.
Yeah, guys, Aaron was so well behaved. I'm so proud of him.
Yeah. Well, there's two separate people you have to learn to be. You can always be the fan, but you still have to be a human being when you're meeting other people.
That's
the surreal part of the experience. You know, it's like we're there in a professional capacity. We can't go like, oh my God, I love your books, blah, 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 because that sets up a very different dynamic with the people you're talking to.
And I think that in all honesty, the conversations that we had, although the situation was surreal and chaotic and like actually incredibly frustrating at times, just in terms of coordinating schedules, the conversations themselves coming out of the keynote, which was just a bombardment of information and new titles and new pitches and a phenomenal lineup of creators to then be able to switch gears and focus on one or two creators at a time and listen more in depth about the individual projects was like really rewarding.
Yeah. So it was a learning experience for me.
Is that the first time that you've ever done any sort of media thing?
Yeah, for the most part.
Okay.
Yeah, not that I can really think of. I'm trying to think like before for other stuff. I mean, there's definitely stuff that I approached maybe either for the podcast or, you know, as sort of like a post-con write-up of an experience, but mm-hmm. definitely not in the same sort of way where we were there with mm-hmm. scheduled interviews to report on a convention.
Right.
Or, you know, whatever, an event.
Yeah. Actually, I think I do want to note that because it isn't a con in any way. And I feel like the perception from our friends who weren't in attendance was that they were really missing out on this like amazing image exclusive con experience. And it's not that. It's a press event. And it's cool that they open it up to, I guess, probably predominantly local fans because they're based in the Bay Area. They're based in Berkeley. But there was not a lot of other stuff. There were panels and signings and minimal retail. But it was just, if you're sitting at home thinking, like, I need to get to Image Expo as a fan, I think that the access is actually, like, better spent at a regular con. Unless yeah. you are there as a member of the media or you're there, like, as a retailer. Then yes. then you can make an argument that the one-on-one access is improved upon. But I actually think that it was less there for those who bought tickets just as general admission. The creator access was less than you would find at a regular con.
Yes. You know, the only exception to that, I would say, is a collector and fan/reseller who is there to get signatures for profit.
Yeah, but you know how I feel about that. It just...
No, but there are people that do that, and I don't want to discount that kind of fan. Like, I'm partly that kind of fan, too. You know, like, Image even set it up that way. There was a CGC person there to witness signatures if you wanted to get...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So if you wanted to get graded books signed and then, you know, shipped off, you could. So it's not entirely... It's a kind of a hybrid of everything, but it's the same thing. Like, if you're sitting in, you know, Nebraska or something like that... wishing you can make it to ImageCon.
Why
it's not
ImageCon. Why would you pick Nebraska of all the places?
What's wrong with Nebraska?
I'm just curious. Like, you just pulled that out of your ass. Just Nebraska. Like,
I got Nebraska on my mind.
Why?
I don't know.
Wait, isn't Omaha in Nebraska?
Sure is. Somewhere in middle America.
Man, it's a flyover state, isn't it?
Well, for some people. Some people, it's a destination.
Man, I think, don't we know some people in Omaha?
Well, if you count the internet. I don't know. I wouldn't meet anyone off the internet.
So crazy.
Anyway.
So crazy. So anyway.
It's not fair to say it's not a fan event, but I think it's a little misleading to make it seem like a destination convention.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think that misleading is coming from Image.
No.
I think that that's a misperception because the tickets are available to the general public and because the creators are available in limited ways at the event. It can be perceived externally as being like just a small con, and it's really not.
No, absolutely right. But that being said, our experience, or at least my experience, with the people we got to talk to, the contacts we made, and kind of the news we got to report, I found it very satisfying.
You know, I wrote a 3,000-word write-up for Comicosity, which was pretty solid, if I do say so myself. It's more than just a collection of the information that came out of the keynote, but also looking at some of the trends that Eric Stevenson spoke of from last year to this year and kind of why they're moving in this direction, as well as some of the trends in the individual announcements. There's just so much great science fiction, and I just thought that that was really interesting and tried to kind of capture some of those more specific descriptions from the individual creators in the write-up. So if you're so inclined and you have like an hour to waste to read me ramble on the internet, it's possibly, even more entertaining to listening to me ramble on the internet.
Oh, for sure. At least from my standpoint.
Right.
I, for one, embrace our science fiction masters. Like, that's my bread and butter. So most of those announcements are like, you know, it's just pandering to me in a way. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting to see, like, I don't know what you think, 80% of those announcements were pure science fiction stories?
It's possible that it's even higher than that. If you are being broad with your genre designation, because so many of the gods and mythology influenced stories also, you know, bring in magic, and they also bring in space, and like there's just a lot of that that falls under the very, very wide umbrella of science fiction. And there were, I can actually only think of three titles that don't fit that description.
Yeah.
And that's, I don't know. And actually, one of them is Nailbiter, which is Josh Williamson. And he sort of teased at the possibility. And I'm not saying that this is a definite thing, but like, is it supernatural? Or is it, like, I think that even some of the stories that didn't sound like obvious science fiction per se could end up veering into territory that is non-realistic or like kind of less likely to be categorized elsewhere. So
yeah, and you know, even being objective after the fact, there's none of those announcements are anything I don't want to pick up.
Yeah, but you're
no,
you're
realistically
an extreme case.
Well, okay, I think from going forward though, when I say pick up, so there's two separate kind of things. Because we, as media inner circle people, whatever, we get media copies of basically everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so
you
we
need
have
to
an
stop using that word.
Look, we're part of the inner circle. It's just
not
just the fact of life.
It's not. It's not an inner circle thing. It's like anybody on the internet who wants to write comics can get promo copies. It's not that hard.
So that being said,
uh-huh,
we can read whatever we want.
Sure.
What we buy is a different matter.
Yeah, I understand that you're making that distinction. I'm not an idiot. I'm saying that you still buy everything.
No, I'm doing pretty good. I'm limited to like 40 a week. That's what we talked about.
No, we said 30.
I don't remember that number.
Uh-huh.
That sounds like 2013, Aaron.
In 2014, Aaron is like, fuck this shit, I'm buying all the comics.
Bigger, better, faster, stronger, longer boxes.
Uh-huh.
That's my motto.
Got it. How many is on your list for this week?
30.
Straight up 30? Like 3-0? Like you're not lying?
Yeah, I've got a reserve list of 10, but, you know, that's the cut list.
Okay.
Yeah, there's
30
on
my list. Are we
going
to talk about comics next week?
Yeah, I think so. You know, we'll see.
Yeah, it's been a couple of weird weeks for us, so.
It's okay. I mean, whatever. We have a great interview this week.
We do. We have a very important interview, and I think that should be the primary focus for today.
I hope so. I really want people to listen to this. I think our discussion with Brian, for me personally, was very enlightening. I've been thinking about it since we finished it. I've been thinking a lot about people, personality types, how we process information, and then how we regurgitate answers back into the world. You know, and it's stuff you think about periodically, but this was a very poignant interview for me. This, I think, was kind of the one that made me think the most.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Just about how people interact with each other.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so for me, it was very special. I hope, you know, I don't know, I hope the people who listen to it find similar insight and kind of understanding, too.
Yeah, I agree. It has certainly been on my mind since we talked to Brian Wood on Sunday, and it's Tuesday now. And so coming off of the past, I guess, week, sure, because Image Expo was on Thursday, and the interviews and the sort of mass stimulus of meeting all of those people and for me dealing with various personality types and just like the volume of processing of information, and then to kind of downshift into a conversation more on par with the types that we normally have, I have been more introspective than normal recently. So
yep.
I think Maybe it's just that time of year as we start heading off into 2014. But I do think that the conversation that we had with Brian Wood was very illuminating for me. So I hope everybody else enjoys it.
Yeah, me too. So I guess now we should just let them listen to it.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys. We'll be back next week, and we promise to talk about comics.
Hi there. My name is Jala, and you can follow me on Twitter at Neon Sky Studio, or you can go to my website, same thing, neonskystudio.com. My best con memory ever has got to be Long Beach Comic Con this past year, because my fiancé, Slade, proposed to me in front of Travis Hansen, my friend and the webcomic artist for the Bean comic. So that is probably my best memory ever. And I don't know, any worst memory is just kind of blown out of the water by that one. So that's what I've got for you. You can also check out my webcomic, which is called Salem Moore, on my website as well. So have a good day.
We're honored and excited to welcome writer Brian Wood to the couch this week. Brian is known for his series DMZ and Northlanders, both published by Vertigo Comics. He's just finishing up his run on Conan the Barbarian, published by Dark Horse Comics, which also publishes his book The Massive, which we've discussed several times on Comics Therapy. And he's writing the main Star Wars title that will wrap up this year as well. He's writing the current X-Men title for Marvel Comics, and we could kind of go on and on, but I'll stop there. Thanks so much for talking with us, Brian. We've been looking forward to this for a while.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
So that was a quick rundown of your past and current projects. But are there others that you want to mention? Or how about anything upcoming that you're allowed to talk about that we should be aware of?
Yeah, well, sort of, but not really. I've sort of been I was really heavily booked up for last 18 months, and I've kind of been letting things end and not rushing to replace them. Basically, that's what counts as a vacation in my life, is not rushing into the next thing immediately. So there's nothing that I can announce, but there I can say there's three creator-owned stuff in various stages of being worked on.
Okay.
I think that's going to be I was like a creator-owned guy for my entire career until very recently.
Right.
And all this license work and work for hire stuff was always sort of meant to be a temporary thing,
Mm-hmm.
It was always the plan to swing the balance back more towards a predominantly creator-owned sort of schedule. So that's what's coming up next.
Is that something that you think will be within 2014, or maybe even beyond that?
It kind of depends on the various publishers, because they sort of have different speeds of working. For example, right now, I'm sorry to speak generally. I'm trying to make this as interesting as possible. But so right now, for example, I just wrote The Massive number 22,
mm-hmm.
and that series ends at issue 30.
Yeah.
Okay.
So right now, I have to start thinking about what I'm going to do at Dark Horse after The Massive.
I see. Uh-huh.
So that's one of the things I'm planning, but that's not going to launch until after The Massive or around the time The Massive ends. So I think that would make it into 2015, I think. But I am sort of, but these other couple of things are moving a lot faster, and it's my intention to have those be the end of this calendar year.
Mm-hmm.
Soon, basically as soon as I can to launch in a responsible manner where we have enough issues in the can,
Yeah. Here's my first page. Here's my working title. Get ready for it.
Well, that was a problem. That was honestly the mistake we made with Mara. Is Image really wanted to get that book out in that calendar year, and we launched it in December, mm-hmm. and it was just way too early, and so the final issue ended up being late. I mean, and that was just a case of us just being dumb about it and not being cautious enough.
Mm-hmm.
So lesson learned there. So.
I think you can spin that and say that you were just really enthusiastic.
Well, you're always anxious. Once you start working on something, you have this drive. You want to get it out. You want to get it out ASAP. For it feeds our egos, of course, and it's good for the income, for bringing in the money and everything. So, yeah, we're always kind of having to put ourselves in check and and think about what's smart as opposed to what we want to do. You know?
Okay. Well, that kind of goes back to, you know, that you've got all these books out and you've got more books in the can, more, you know, more working, and that's a, and you have a busy family life too. You know, we're parents ourselves. We're always interested in kind of that work-life balance.
Yeah.
And it's really been interesting to hear, have these conversations with creators to hear how different people deal with that. I'm kind of curious, what does a typical work day look like for you?
It's actually interesting because I pay attention to other, peers of mine who have kids, and I don't know how they do it either. I think we all must do everything in a different way. A typical day is I wake up really early and everybody leaves the house at the same time. My wife goes to work and I take both the kids who go to different schools, they're different ages, and I drop each of them off. And so I'm back at home around 9. And in theory, I now have a block of work time from 9 until 12:30 or so. In theory, I mean, a lot of that time gets eaten up with, like, if I have to run errands, I have to go to the post office, I have to go to the grocery store. I'm the stay-at-home dad. I mean, that's sort of all that stuff falls under my responsibilities. If I'm going to go to the gym, I go to the gym then often. And then at 12:30, I have to go pick up the youngest kid, bring him home. That eats up an hour and a half. He has this like nap time type thing, whatever it is. And then my wife comes home having picked up the older kid on the way. That's around like three, I should say. So then also in theory, I have a block of work time between then and dinner. And as you know, you have kids, the whole dinner, bath, bedtime, like smorgasbord block of time.
Yeah.
It's like a solid like three hours, you know,
if you're lucky.
And then I have to work at night. So it's been really hard. And like, I was able to do all the books I was doing for that 18 months because the schedule then was different than what I just described. And so part of the reason I've been scaling back is my schedule changed a bit. So I actually don't have as much time to write as I did then. So it is like really, really hard. I mean, I've sort of trained myself to write faster than I did, like say when I was working at Vertigo, which helps. But there's always, I think my editors have learned to give me a lot of fake deadlines because I don't always hit them. And I think they've adjusted on their end.
So that, intermittent deadline that you can work towards, even if it's not like the final one.
They tell you, Brian, you can't get it to us any later than January 11th, and it's really, you know, January 22nd that they need it.
Right. Well, it's not that bad. It's not that much time. But I'm also aware of where the artists are, like Gary Brown on The Massive. Like, he's sending me his pages as he draws them.
Yeah.
So, like, I know when he's getting close to being done with a script. So I can, I also use that as, like, a gauge, too, you know. But yeah, so it's been hard. Like I said, I've been slowing down, sort of taking it easy, catching up, trying to figure out exactly what I can responsibly handle in the schedule side.
Well, even on that schedule too, it's like, okay, you get home at 9, say on an ideal day, you can't. It doesn't seem like it would be realistic then to just sit down and type. You know, there's still mental transition time.
Yeah, there's mental transition. There's like a million emails I have to answer. Like, I'm getting, there's all the other aspects of work that isn't writing a script.
Yeah.
Like approving art or answering questions or finding reference for the artists or like edits. Like, you get the lettering files, and usually you can go back and do like a final like dialogue polish, you know, once everything's lettered, you can see what's flowing right and what's not, you know, what's awkward.
Yeah.
So there's all that stuff too. And that's often what the mornings are. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a reason we're all talking right now on a Sunday afternoon.
Right.
Yeah. And usually one of my weekend days is a work day. That's like the deal I made with my wife. Really, one of the days I'll be fully I'll be like a 100% dad, and the other day I work.
It's interesting that depending on who we've talked to and depending on the age of the kids involved, it has shifted for some of these creators. When the kids are much younger, I mean, my son is 8, and so I have a different perspective than Aaron, whose kids are much younger, about how much freedom I have in my day versus how much you kind of need to be engaged with much younger kids. So I'm not surprised at all that you're sort of seeing your time shift over the past 18 months or longer also. And I'm sure it'll just continue to be like that. Kids, hey,
yeah, I mean, I mean, my oldest one is 7 years old. So that, like, she can, like if I tell her, I'm like, go find something to do, she'll happily go and find something to do, you know? But the younger one, who's a 3, it's like a constant. He just, anything he does involves me.
Or if it doesn't, that means something's going to get destroyed or.
So, you know, it's like, it's different. So, I mean, you know, and this transition was when he was like much younger and we had like, you know, a babysitter that would watch him. I had a lot more time and freedom, you know.
Yeah.
You can see once he actually starts going to kindergarten.
Right.
That's my light at the end of the at the end of the tunnel there, when I know it'll change again in my favor, you know.
What are some of the things that you do with your family, like, to sort of help balance and decompress from, like, shifting from working and writing to the rest of your life?
Well, there's a few, like, sort of like I mean, I call it like a structural thing. Anything that has to do with my job is in my office. Like,
so
all
helps,
the comics, anything that looks like a comic or has anything to do with comics is in an office. So when I'm done, I can close the door, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I made it and like mentally close it and physically, literally close it.
Yeah.
And I'm done, you know, that, like, you know, like when I start dinner, like, it shuts and my editors know that from 5 until 7, I'm not available, you know? Like, I never try to, like, get my kids into comics. Like, I try not to have those two worlds overlap. Like, I'm not going to discourage them, but I'm not also one of these people that when my kid was like 1, I'm reading him like a Tiny Titans comic. Like, like, as long as I can put that off, the better, as far as I'm concerned, you know? And so, and also that just helps me. Like, I want to be able to clock out at the end of the day, you know?
That's unusual, just in our extremely limited, like, anecdotal research, right? And talking to people for
you know,
past 6 months.
Yeah.
It's encouraging, but it's relatively unusual that you insist on that separation. I happen to think it's actually really healthy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to come off like a dick and say I insist upon it, you know, because obviously if they're into it, then they're into it. That's fine, you know.
I have a mental image of you, like, ransacking your son's room when he's older and finding some X-Men comics under his bed and saying,
I know,
"What
right?
is this? What is this?"
Comics.
Exactly.
I know. Only ruin your life.
So it kind of, I feel like it actually helps me be like a better dad because I can relax better.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm sort of like, I can just like turn off that part of my brain and not worry or stress or get anxious, you know, if I'm worrying about a deadline or something. So,
You've also talked really openly about, like, your fitness routine. And I'm just curious if you use that kind of physical exertion as another part of balancing out, like, the mental workout that you go through as a writer.
That wasn't the intention. I mean, it was really sort of, I mean, that change, which is almost exactly a year ago, was like a long time in the coming. It was just sort of like, you know, they always say, like, they usually say it when someone's trying to quit smoking, it's never going to work until, like, in your head you're ready, you know? Like,
mm-hmm.
you have to be fully ready in your own mind to, like, make this a change, you know?
Right.
And so I'd, like, sort of built up to that and a lot of false starts. And it was, like, right after my birthday last year, I was just like, okay, the time is now. Like, that switch flipped in my head. I definitely feel better. I mean, it takes up more of my work time, And that definitely had an impact. You know, like that was a trade-off I had to make. Mm-hmm. You know, like I know, you know, there are only so many hours in the day. If I spend, you know, X amount of them at the gym now, that's less time writing. You know, right. So I guess you can say there's added stress on the other side of that. There's never not been a time that I've left the gym not feeling like a million bucks. Like just feeling like mentally, emotionally, just better, you know?
Yeah.
So I know it's like helping in some ways that I can't fully define exactly what it's doing, but it's definitely a positive effect. It's definitely made me a better person and a happier person and healthier, obviously, and everything.
Good.
So yeah. And it's like anytime I'm like angry at the world or mad at my job or career, like I don't feel that way after I go to the gym. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. At least not for like a period of time.
Right. Well, can we step back for a second and talk about childhood? Well, more kind of, you know, where your career path has led to. Like, did you read comics as a kid? And I kind of think I know the answer to this because I've heard you talk about it before, but kind of wanted to ask again. You didn't really, did you?
I never did in the way that a lot of my peers did.
Right.
I mean, I remember seeing comics. I remember possibly buying a couple, but like I didn't always know what I was reading. It was like I remember Richie Rich comics of all things. Like I remember those. I remember them clearly. Like I must have owned them and read them over and over again. Mm-hmm. Like I can see them in my head. Or like I would read them at the dentist office, but it just wasn't a thing that I read regularly.
Yeah.
So I didn't really know who any of the characters were. And part of it was, I was like raised in a household where there wasn't media. Like mm-hmm. we didn't have TV, or if we did, it was only channel 13. So I knew who Spider-Man was because he was on the Electric Company.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Like,
yeah.
So there was like bits and pieces like that, but I was never exposed to anything enough to form the attachments that I see a lot of my peers talk about.
So, you know? So what was in the house? Was it books? Like, what were your early creative inspirations?
It was books. It was like, I mean, it was like all the young adult books that every kid should read, like all the Henry Huggins and Beverly Cleary and Ramona books and uh-huh. Encyclopedia Brown. And like, I mean, all those sort of like the normal things. Little House on the Prairie was like a really big thing when I was a kid. Because I had like an older sister, like a lot of the stuff I read was like the quote girl books, like The Little House on the Prairie or Harriet the Spy, you mm-hmm. know, like I like read all that stuff, all the Judy Blume books, even the stuff about the periods and everything. I read all that,
sure.
You know,
yeah.
all those like more girl ones, you know, mm-hmm. And I just read everything. That's pretty much all I did. I mean, we also lived in a very rural part of Vermont. So it's also like a very like outdoorsy kind of life.
Interesting, yeah.
And there wasn't just a lot of TV, and it wasn't until I forget when it was when suddenly like I was like more aware of the world and sort of like maybe like junior high school when I began to sort of see movies or the TV restriction was like let up a bit. I remember I used to read Gru. I guess it was Epic, Marvel's Epic line of Gru. I remember buying those, and those were like funny, but they weren't really comics in the sense that it wasn't the Marvel or DC universe.
Yeah,
just like grew.
And,
just
but they're
grew.
Also
that's
pretty.
All I did.
They're
you know?
Kind of smart. Like that Aragone stuff is, you know, he's it's very satirical and kind of has a level of intelligence to it too.
Yeah, I'm sure so much of it was just like going way over
sure.
my head.
Yeah.
But it was funny. So like I read that, but again, it was like very, you know. I mean, I saw the Superman movie, you know, it was like that. It was just like very casual. So, I mean, I always say whenever somebody asks them, like, this is why I, you know, have the career in comics that I have and why I have the troubles that I have when it comes to trying to like pitch for or write these like superhero books. Like, I don't know these characters,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like I'm so much in the, I'm even now, like even after years of like the X-Men, there's still stuff. I'm just like, who is this?
Right.
Like our editors are like, you do know that X, Y, and Z happened in the past. I'm like, no, I don't. You know? So I'm always at this disadvantage. I'm always sort of like, in a sense, I'm like not part of the group. You know, I don't speak the same language or have the same shared influences or like experiences as a lot of my writer friends.
Right, because it's sort of almost like religion in a way, that if you, so many people who are very involved in Marvel or DC have that in that lifetime of indoctrination as well. You know, and if you kind of are brought into the fold from outside, I think creatively that brings a very interesting perspective to these properties that often need some refreshing or can really benefit from a fresh voice. But at the same time, you have people very loyal to characters who know everything that's happened in the last, you know, 70 years to them, right, inside and out. And you still have to be aware of that too. So yeah, that's got to be a very interesting experience when you're not... you're not the Alakite of, you know, this superhero, right, religion like everyone else might be.
But it was interesting when I started working on the Star Wars book, which is something I do know everything there is to know about, at least. Well, that, I shouldn't even say that. That's, you know, I'm going to set myself up there. Okay. Like, I mean, Star Wars is something that I did experience when I was a kid and like and enjoy, and I know a lot about it. So when I started writing that book, you know, talking to the editor, Randy, who's like knows everything, and all the other Star Wars writers, I was like, oh, this is what it's like. This is what it's like to go to a writer's summit at Marvel, where you and everybody else knows everything. Like, you're all part of the group. You know, like, this is what it's like. Now I understand, you know? Uh-huh. Because I don't have that. I don't have that base of knowledge or that camaraderie.
Yeah,
with the Marvel writers as I do with the Star Wars ones.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of fun to imagine that you can kind of bounce between both of those experiences. Because I think that the perspective point is valid. Sometimes it's of benefit to be slightly outside of that inner circle, but it's also kind of fun to be part of it too. So.
Yeah, there's a benefit. It's a benefit because of the jobs I get hired for. They're deliberately hiring me because they want somebody who's a little bit on the outside of it. Like they want that perspective, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and that's great. I'm like, I would much rather have that role than have to do like a ton of research and ask a lot of stupid questions constantly and mess up, and the book comes out and the fans are like, Brian doesn't understand these books, you know. It's like it's hard there. I mean, I get that happens, you know. So I would much rather be on more like on the fringes of things, like whether it be like in the Ultimate Universe or doing like these sort of like mini series on the side, you know. It can be hard when it can be hard on like X-Men writing like this core book and sort of having to be like aware of all this stuff, you know?
Oh yeah, right. But at least you have editors to help fact check though and make edits and kind of.
Yeah, and they're always super nice. I mean, they're really sort of the true heroes of these books. I don't know how they keep everything straight, mm-hmm. everything running, all these books all at once, you know. I only have to think about one, but they have to think about, I don't know, 12.
Right. You know? Yeah. Well, so let's skip forward a little bit. And, you know, you originally pursued a career in illustration and you worked in the video game industry for a while. And I know you talked about this a little bit before, but what was that moment when comics seemed like the career path you wanted to pursue over the others?
All right. So I was in art school and, that's really when I got into comics. Mm-hmm. I was aware of commercial illustrators, Dave McKean and Kent Williams. Like I knew them for the stuff they did for like record covers and book covers, not their comics.
Uh-huh.
And then someone said, these guys make comics. And so again, I'm thinking of Gru and I'm thinking of Richie Rich. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. Uh-huh. You know, like Dave McKean, you know, come on. So
I would totally buy that.
like that was my visual picture of a comic book was like a Richie Rich comic, you know, like that level of that era. And it just didn't make any sense, you know? And so I went to the comic store, and that's when I saw Vertigo Comics.
Mm-hmm.
Like early on, like this is like the middle of the 90s. And so I was like, all right. So like I picked up a few like random things, like John Van Fleet was an artist I really liked early on. And So then, I mean, then that sort of began my backwards education. Then I started to, like, you know, I was like into it. I'm like, hey, this is something that I recognize, in the sense that this is something I could do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is the kind of art I like. This is the kind of art I'm in school to learn how to make, you know.
But you were still at that point thinking about it as an artist, as opposed to as a writer.
Yes. Yeah. The whole writer thing comes later. and so I was like, okay. So I began to get into that. I found, like, Frank Miller. I was pretty into that. Then by this time I had, like, read all, like, the seminal books everybody should read, like Watchmen and Dark Knight and Frank Miller's Daredevil books and all these sort of all, like, the highlights,
yeah.
You know, and those slowly filling in the gaps. And I was also, but the one comic, the first comic that connected with me emotionally, not just on, like, a appreciation of the art level, but emotional level, was Peter Bagg's Hate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so then I was getting into all, like, the Fantagraphics indies, like Minimum Wage and all, mm-hmm, that stuff, which I liked as, like, a person. Like, that was what I was enjoying reading, mm-hmm, not just looking at the art for, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a couple of, like, things happening there, like the Vertigo side of things, and then the Fantagraphics autobiographical stuff. Yeah, so then I just began to, I was like, comics are cool, comics are interesting, they're like a mix of everything, mm-hmm, you know, you can do anything with, like I was sort of like discovering them as like a potential, not so much a career path, I don't even think I was there yet, I just wanted to make them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And onwards through a college until my senior project was sort of like a short version of what was the Channel Zero book. Like, I wrote and drew it, and I wrote it because I didn't know any writers and because I was too much of a control freak. You know, like, this was mine. Like, I want to draw what I want to draw. Therefore, I have to write it. You know. And it was like, first draft, who gives a shit? I don't know if I can swear.
Sure. Sorry.
Absolutely.
Like, I didn't even, like, it was not even the slightest consideration what the writing was. Like, I just had to get there so I could draw it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I self-published it along with some of my friends in school. We, like, pooled our money and printed up a thing that looked like a real comic. And I brought it to San Diego and gave it out to everybody I could think of. And that's how, you know, that's how it happened at Image. And it still wasn't really like a job. It was sort of like this thing I did. And I had a job at that point. I was out of school. It was a dot-com boom. And if you were an idiot if you weren't working in the dot-com industry. Okay. In New York City then. It was like stupid money and it was easy, you know?
Yeah, I was down in San Francisco too. It was sort of the same thing.
Yeah, I was making banner ads for $75,000 a year,
right?
Which was crazy at the time. I was so broke all through a college, and then suddenly it was like, like, literally more money than I knew what to do with.
Mm-hmm.
And then it sort of gradually happened. Like, I had written all of Channel Zero, and still was not really caring about the writing. Like, it was still very first draft. I was into it, but I wasn't really, I felt like I wasn't respecting it enough. Like, I wasn't spending as much time on the writing as I should have.
Mm.
But somehow, still based on that, I got that Generation X writing job with Warren Ellis, who I was friends with at that point, who was clearly picking me up and throwing me into the deep end. And it worked. And then, I mean, I was learning. It was like still such a learning. I mean, I'm still learning how to write, you know, but that was like my first only writing job. And it was interesting. And my day job at that point was such that I just didn't have the time or the energy to draw. And I was never fast. And I did a lot of samples. I'm early on at Vertigo. Like, they had me come in. I did samples for Invisibles,
mm,
and for House of Secrets,
mm-hmm,
like multiple pages of sample art. Just as like a tryout, you know, they were, mm-hmm, like, Shelley Bond is like, you know, we'll see if you can be a fill-in artist on the Invisibles, which is crazy. But the art was like never there. They're like, it's too weird. It's not right, you know. And it was like just so gradually over these years, I just sort of like stopped. And it was clear that I could get work as a writer, and I could not get work as an artist. So, or the only work as an artist I could get is if I did Channel Zero again, which is if I did something all on my own and just did it and put it out. And I just didn't have the time or like the financial situation, you know, to do that.
But that can't be the case these days. Like if you wanted to get back to art, I'm sure you have enough industry cachet now to like do that, right?
I still think I would have to go the Channel Zero route and just do it all in my own at like Image.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure Image would say yes. But I mean, even now I can't get a cover work. I mean, I never could. I mean, the jobs I got as a cover artist were, I mean, it was like Global Frequency, mm-hmm. which was like Warren Ellis saying Brian's the cover artist.
Uh-huh.
And Wallstrom being like, okay, I guess so. You know, they were never fully, I remember like I gotten so many arguments with the art director that I can't even think of his name, but he just hated all those covers.
Hmm.
I got the Eisner nomination for it and couldn't get any cover work after that. And then I did DMZ covers because that was my own book.
Yeah, right.
So that's it, really. I mean, that's all I was ever able to get, not for lack of trying.
Do you miss it? Do you miss drawing or using, I guess, more either drawing or graphic design, like to express yourself creatively?
I don't miss it because I managed to get enough of it out of me that I'm satisfied.
Hmm.
Like I always do. Like I do logos for virtually every book. I like all my creator own work. I do the logo for. I often do the cover layouts too.
Okay.
Like all the Northlanders covers. Like I'd get the art and I'd do the logos up and place them and whatever. Same thing with DMZ. I did all the covers for the DMZ trades and I'm doing the covers again for like the deluxe edition. So I mean I do enough of it where it's fine.
Okay,
you know?
Yeah.
And if I ever have that like itch to do more, I can figure it out. Like there's always some outlet there that like keeps me satisfied. But I mean, so much time now has passed, you know, and I've come to accept like my limitations as an artist.
Yeah.
Like I can really only do one thing. and I've embraced that, you know, and it's very much that Channel Zero DMZ sort of urban thing, you know. That is my comfort zone, and I've accepted it. and it's fine. Like I make a lot of t-shirts. That's fun too.
Yeah.
Right. Well, so in recent months, some members of the comic book industry have chosen to kind of make you a focal point when there were discussions about feminism and sexual harassment in the industry. And I'm curious if that's given you an opportunity, like personally, to think about some changes that you would want to see in the industry moving forward.
Well, sure. I mean, it's interesting. I think just that at this past in New York Comic-Con, I was having, not to sound like a name dropper, but I was having dinner with Felicia Day, who's sort of like my regular New York Comic-Con dinner date.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're like friends, casual friends, and that's when we usually, you know, hang out. And we're just like talking about stuff. And then I made a comment to her. I said, you know, I really feel like, you know, like things are changing in comics as far as this goes. And she didn't really, she hadn't seen it. So we were talking about it. And I couldn't really put my finger down, but I'm just like a lot more people are talking about it. Like, you know, the publishers are putting out more books that seem to be like aware of like a lack of diversity.
Yeah,
you know, like my X-Men book or all the female-led books Marvel's doing, or the lack of them at DC, and like that conversation as well.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, "Huh, really?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I think so." And then like a month later, it's like, you know, it's like a nuclear bomb going off, you know.
Right.
And I think it's, I mean, I don't know. I have complicated feelings about like, I don't know. Because of books I've done or because of working with friends of mine who are women in the past. Like, I often get the feminist label applied to me. Mm-hmm. I'm not super comfortable with that. I mean, I take it as a compliment because it's meant as one. It's nice. And I would never.
But I noticed that you don't use that yourself.
I never do, and it's really hard to say why. Like, I'm not comfortable with it. Like I see it, and I get an uncomfortable feeling. Hmm. And a lot, I mean, it's, I think a lot of it is, like, all wrapped up in, like, thoughts of, like, my mother, who is, like, one of those 1970s National Organization of Women feminists. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I'm not doing anything that's like that. Like, I'm not contributing in the way where I feel like I deserve. I feel like I deserve that. Like, I'm not there yet. Like, I'm very much aware that I'm, like, a white guy in my 40s, mm-hmm. with all my flaws. And so I don't use that label. Like, I don't feel like I have earned it. I also feel like a lot of guys use it like a sticker. Like they've unlocked an achievement. I'm a feminist, you know, uh-huh. or whatever. And it feels like very self-congratulatory. Or it doesn't feel like it means anything when they say it. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I'll ever feel comfortable with it, or if and I don't mean to say that any other guy should, like, agree with me, or that I'm judging any other guys. It's, like, purely just how I feel, and it's very mm-hmm. deep down in my own gut, you know. Like, if someone else wants to call themselves a feminist, I'm not going to say they're wrong, obviously. So yeah, I never do, and. Like, I feel like I want to work with Becky because she's, like, a friend of mine, not because I'm trying to, like, make a statement,
yeah.
you know? So I've always just tried to do what I do. I take the compliment. I'm, like, proud of my work, you know? I feel like if it's helped, I don't really know if it has, then that's awesome. But I don't wear that badge.
Well, so if you wanted to ensure that, like, in whatever, 10 years, 15 years, if your daughter or one of her friends was interested in getting involved in the industry, do you think that there are things that the industry as a whole could be doing differently to kind of forge the path in a more positive direction?
I mean, I think it kind of is. And I think that's, I mean, I think what I hear people say most often, and I would agree with this, like, in this recent conversation, is that just comics, or the comics industry and the comics themselves, just have to better reflect the changing world. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true, and that's such a broad statement. That can mean, like, a million things. But I think as a concept, that's 100% right on. Mm-hmm. And I don't really feel like we're quite there yet. And I think what's probably going to happen is, like, a overcompensation until it finds its balance, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, I think now this conversation is, like, a little overblown, and I'm sure I'm going to get in trouble for saying that, but there's such a high level of sensitivity and scrutiny,
yeah.
on the comics and on the industry and how the industry works. I feel like everything is getting policed to, like, a degree that's not sustainable. And I feel like I feel like this conversation is at, like a sugar high right now, and it'll calm down. And that's when I feel like we'll see what changes have taken hold.
Yeah. And it seems also sort of generational too, that we have sort of a new crop of people entering the industry.
Right, right. And I don't really think I'm part of that as much as I might want to be. Like, again, I'm going back to, like, understanding that I'm, like, a 40-year-old white guy.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I'm the guy that is going to be an engine of change, or really should be, mm-hmm. you know? As weird as that is for me to say, I don't feel like I'm that guy, but I know that's what everybody sees when they look at me. You mm-hmm, know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like everybody's trying. I feel like all my editors at Marvel are genuinely trying, and I feel like Marvel's doing a pretty good job of actually, I think more than anybody else, really, in, like, if you want to take, like, the top, I don't know, 7 or 8 publishers, they're the ones that are, like, putting their necks out, you
yeah.
know, and putting their money on the line and taking these risks, mm-hmm. whether they're perfect or imperfect or fail or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
I give them a lot of credit for that. But I just, I feel like the biggest problem, and this is the thing I always think about when I, you know, see myself getting like attacked online or something, is virtually everybody I know that makes comics is like guilty of it all too. It's such a boys club. It's such a boys club, and people act like idiots and immature jerks and horrible misogynists. And it's like locker room humor all the time. That's virtually all I've ever seen. And you know, like I'm myself and a couple other people are the ones that get sort of picked out of the group as the examples to be made. But there's like, I mean, I could tell you 20 people who are doing stuff right now, like doing it now, seeming to care about. And I could think of, I'm sure I'm not even on the top 100, you know, it's so, like such a profound level, type of behavior that I see everybody doing.
Do you think it's like exacerbated because the industry is smaller and much more insular? And so I'm just thinking about what you just said in terms of reflecting what's going on in society. And so if the comics industry is maybe a couple steps behind kind of cleaning up its locker room act, and that is because it has stayed a boys club longer, that the response to like recent events will, like you said, kind of blow up and then self-regulate. And then we can start to see what changes have been kind of more permanently been instilled into the industry.
Honestly, I don't know. Like I hate to say it. I don't feel hopeful when it comes to like the group that I'm a part of in the generational sense.
So it is a generational thing in that regard, maybe? I don't know. It's so really strange as an outsider to like try to make those connections, but I find myself agreeing with you that it is generational. If that's what you're saying.
I think it's, well, I guess when I say generational, I feel like there's like, I just don't see a lot of my peers ever changing.
Right.
I feel like they're not going to change. They're going to like die off. We're like the old Republicans. I hate to use that. But we're eventually just going to become less relevant and be pushed aside for like, you know, the younger crop that's coming out of like web comics are just more like aware or come from like a different generation, you know. We all act like we're kids in comics. And I've had this like blog post saved for like months that I keep editing, and I'm like afraid to put it out there. But it really is sort of about what I've seen over these years, especially when I was at Vertigo and now, and reasons for why I've disengaged from the social world of comics. Mm-hmm. Because it's like junior high school in so many ways. It's like backstabbing and horrible, stupid jokes and shitty behavior. And again, I'm like, we're all in our 40s and we have kids. Like, why are we acting like this? Like, why are we staying out drinking until 4 a.m. and showing up at the convention reeking and like talking, saying horrible things about the women we know and everything? Like, what? Like, we're adults. We're supposed to be adults, you know? And that happens everywhere, constantly. And I just couldn't take it anymore. It was like several years. It was actually when I left. I had a big sea change when I was basically kicked out of DC. That sort of caused me to like reevaluate my career. In a way, I had the reset button hit, you know, and I had to like think differently. And I was just sort of like, I just can't do it anymore. Like, I don't want to do all the parties. I don't want to do this. I have to like pay attention to the work. It's not as easy as I thought it was gonna be. Like, I felt like I was really set at Vertigo, and I had a clearer path, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that completely went away. And I'm like, all right, I gotta like, you know, I got to work harder now to get what I want. Like, I got to try harder and think differently. So I really cut down on the conventions I did, and I stopped going out. Like, I would go back to my room after the convention every time. I just couldn't deal with the scene, you mm-hmm. know? And I don't think that scene will ever change. I really, really don't. Mm. I did a recent convention, like, after all my online troubles, and the guys that were there, even though they had just seen what I had gone through, were not changing the way they acted, you know? And I wanted to be like, did you not, have you learned nothing from me? Mm-hmm. You know, you're still going to go to the strip club. Oh, you're still going to hit on that girl. Okay. You know, like, what the fuck? I just couldn't believe it. And, so I don't know, like, that's such a negative answer for me to give, but deep down, I don't think that my group, meaning this, like, age bracket of guys that make comics, are going to change them that much.
What? The analogy to politics is, or maybe politics and public policy is interesting to me, because yeah. I have felt that way about societal change for a while. And there are obviously a couple of key issues that I could mention by name that I won't, but I feel like the split, the generational divide and that split isn't going to heal itself. And it is pretty awful to talk about, well, the older ones will just die off. But on the other hand, if the change is really going to be authentic, it's probably going to come from elsewhere. So
the other thing is that a lot of, like, my peers don't really think they're the problem, which is why they don't change the way they act. Mm-hmm. Which is the other thing I've noticed, like the level of hypocrisy surrounding the way I'm attacked by sure. the people who are, like, I just want to be like, I've seen you at conventions, Mr. X, mm-hmm. you know, like, you're going to talk to me. Like, I saw you, you know, that kind of thing. And so they don't really think they're the problem. So there's not a lot of reason for them to change. And clearly they're, a lot of them aren't.
Or they
think it's not their job to change, or they think they are because they're doing cool image books that are interesting and not superhero or what. I don't know. I'm really not a part of the social comics group. So I'm a bit on the outside looking in. So this is all just what I feel like I'm seeing. I don't really know how much of it is accurate. Obviously I don't know what anybody's thinking in their own head, you
right.
know.
And you've talked about being kind of on the outside a little bit, and you've spoken really openly about the challenges of being an introvert, especially with conventions and meeting fans, and Aaron can attest to my lack of success with dealing with the crowd at Image Expo this past week. I can definitely relate to the, like, mental energy it takes to be on in those chaotic environments. And I was just an attendee. But that yeah. depletion of, like, personal energy it can be really difficult. So do you think that fans have unreasonable expectations of you that reflect that they just don't understand what it's like to be a creator, the demands on you, and then adding on that level or that layer of being an introvert in those situations as well?
I don't want to say they have unreasonable expectations. Because I feel like I don't want to imply that I'm placing blame on a fan, you know,
okay.
like they want
sure.
to come to a show, and whatever they think, like, Grant Morrison is, or Kirkman or Brian Wood, whatever they think that person is, that's who they, of course, expect to see, you know? As you, I'm sure you know from talking to everybody, is that that's not always the case.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, a lot of us are introverts at various levels. So, like, I think this job is appealing to, like, a lot of introverts, or a lot of the stuff introverts do as kids, like there's, like, a path, and this is one of we, like, sit alone in our room 80% of the time, you know. It's awesome.
Right.
It's great for us, you know. I mean, again, not to bring up Felicia Day, but she's an introvert, and you would never think that, you know, but she, I mean, it's, you know, when she told me that, because she's the one that sort of got me reading the books about it, and I sort of began to understand myself a bit better. I just always would call myself, oh, I was like shy or I'm quiet. You know, I have like this like lifetime's speech impediment that sort of has added to that, you know. And so then I read this book, and I'm like, oh, and this all makes sense. Like, obviously, I'm an introvert. I guess I kind of knew that. But now I sort of understand why and how it affects this and that and why so many people are like an asshole to me, you know, because they don't understand it, you know, whatever. So like a lot of us are, and some of us can be on at a convention, basically acting.
Yeah.
And
okay.
There are people that are really good at that. Like, I know Matt Fraction identifies as an introvert, and he's like super charming and outgoing, and he can really, you know, he can sort of overcome it in the convention situation and be on stage and be cool. And I can just barely function, like barely function like on a panel, you know? And then you add on, you know, the length of the day, the amount of times you have to talk, the amount of talking you have to do, that can like hurt after a while. Like, my throat always hurts at the end of the day. The mental wear of having to answer the same questions over and over again. And this is the job. Like, I'm not complaining about it. It's what everybody signs up for when they attend a convention. And I'm not saying it's like unreasonable or like you shouldn't have to do it, but it's just part of the job. And for some people, it's just profoundly hard.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you start to get cracks in the facade, and you start to not be as friendly as you should, or you want to, or you're tired, or you don't hear somebody and they think you like ignore them or whatever. I mean, there's like a million reasons why like a fan can walk away feeling less than pleased, you know, satisfied, or it didn't go the way they wanted it to. And I've written about it before, and I feel really bad because it's not fun for me. A lot of the times, like, I know when it happens, when someone walks away, I'm like, oh man, that didn't go well, you know, or that sucks. Or I don't have an answer for their question and they walk away and I'm just like, oh man, I wish I had answered that better, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, then sometimes I read about it on the internet, which is always fun. And that's upsetting. And so it's like, it is such a part of our job. You kind of have to do it. You have to be out there, whether it's physically at a convention or, you know, making yourself available on the computer, on the internet. You sort of have to, and there's no answer. I mean, everybody, I've heard similar sort of comments and complaints and frustrations from everybody on the spectrum of professional, you know, all the way up. And I just think it's an unnatural thing for, I think there's like 1% of the human population that can genuinely thrive in a convention situation, you know?
Yeah.
So like everybody, it's hard for everybody in some way, you know?
Right.
And it seems like the people that would thrive in a convention situation aren't the same people then that could go back to a job that is pretty solitary, you know? It's either you're an extrovert who thrives on that human interaction all the time, but then you're not going to pursue a job where you're writing in a room by yourself.
Right.
Or you're drawing, you know, drawing for 8 to 12 hours a day by yourself.
Right.
So it's very, you know, contradictory. You are not going to find those people then at the conventions.
And it doesn't mean that it's not fun if you're an introvert. Like, you can really enjoy quite a bit of it, even though it is taxing and difficult. It doesn't mean that it's not full of joy.
Right. No, I remember I said something about this. I think Ivan Brandon wrote online, like in response to something I was saying about this. And he said, well, when I have a table at a convention, I stand up the whole day. Like, I like reach my hand out first and shake their hand and ask them questions. And I'm like engaging with them. I'm like, you know, that's what he thinks is the correct way, or like the right way to like run a table at a convention. Mm-hmm. And there's like nothing about that that is the slightest bit natural to me. To me, like I couldn't do it even if I tried. I mean, I literally could not. And so I generally try to match what I'm getting. Uh-huh. And because not everybody, it's like the same thing when I walk into a retail store, I don't always want the person to immediately approach me and ask me what I want, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I just assume that everybody at my table at a convention doesn't want the same level of interaction from me. You know, there are some people who clearly just want a book signed. And they come up and they don't say anything. They just slide the book across the table. And so I'm like, okay, so like I sign it, I'll say thanks or I'll make some comment. And they're gone. And you know, like transaction complete, you know. And then there are other people that come up without a book and they just want to chat and they have a question that's awesome or they want to show me something. And so like I try to like gauge what they want and okay. give them that level back, you know, and that's sort of, I've found a good level of success with that. But there are the guys that come up and they're quiet and they're shy and they could be very much like me, you know, and still walk away feeling bummed because they weren't able to give me a level of energy that, mm-hmm. that they wanted from me, you know? So it's never perfect.
Yeah. Well, human interaction rarely is, too. So I guess in a way, it's, you know, it's a pretty accurate reflection of just the rest of the society.
Right.
Well, on a lighter note, what do you have any recommendations for what comics people should be reading these days? I mean, besides your own, because we talked about all those and everyone should be reading them. Is there anything that I know with being busy, you probably don't have a ton of time to read a lot of stuff for pleasure that's comics related.
Yeah, I don't read a lot of comics. This is also a very common question, and part of it ties back into the whole thing where when I'm done with my work day, I want to clock
mm-hmm.
out.
Yeah.
You know, like if I read a comic, I'm so aware of the background of it,
yeah,
of
sure.
like the mechanics and the personalities and stuff that it's always not. I can't ever lose myself in a comic the way I used to, which is a real shame. But I mean, I do read comics. I tend to have like my group of like friends who make comics, and I'll read anything that they do. Like I'll read Jason Aaron's comics. Mm-hmm. That other Star Wars book that Gabriel Hardman draws, that his wife writes, Corina. So that's good. I read that. I read every Star Wars comic actually. But most of my reading, I have to say, if it's not research related, like I also read to one degree or another every single X-Men comic, which is a bit of a task.
Yeah, that could keep you busy.
Because there sure are a lot of those. Yeah,
absolutely.
But a lot of the reading I'm doing is like work related research. Honestly, I don't read a lot of stuff that's purely for pleasure. And because I have these three creator owned books I'm doing, it's like for like the last like 7 or 8 months, I've just been reading up. Mm-hmm. on what they're about, you know, stuff, research stuff. And that's, I've always done a lot of that. I did a lot of it for DMZ and Northlanders.
Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm.
That's honestly where most of my reading time is spent, unfortunately.
No, it's understandable.
And it's a common thing. Like I talk to a lot of friends who will secretly say that I don't read any comics.
Mm-hmm. That's not that it's not an uncommon answer actually with people yeah. we've talked to, just because of it's either the awareness of the construction of them or time, or you know, a mix of time and two, or just being so intimately familiar with creators that you don't, with everyone else in the industry, that you can't separate your friendship from the work, and you know, it loses the pleasure of it too.
Yeah, or you're like picking it apart. Like I picked up something and I realized I read it like several pages without really reading it. What I was just thinking about, like how I could find a way to work with the colorist.
Uh-huh.
You know? And I'm like, hold on, I got to back up and start over again because I wasn't really paying attention to what I was reading.
Uh-huh.
It's like that kind of stuff.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, yep. Thank you, Brian. This was awesome. I really appreciate your candor, and it's been great to talk with you about your work and your life and everything that's been going on.
No, it's so much more fun to answer questions like that than, you know,
the standard. Tell us about yeah. the X-Men.
Did you pitch Star Wars or did they come to you? Yeah, questions like that. I'm always happy to answer, but they do happen in every single interview. So it's nice to talk about other things.
Sorry, I was just about to get to that one. do you have any last words of wisdom for our listeners, or anything that you want to mention that we skipped whether or not you pitched Star Wars?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really gonna miss writing that book, I have to say. I'm actually into my last two issues.
Oh, really?
My 20. Yeah, so I'm like writing way ahead on that book. And it's sort of like, you know, I mean, I sort of knew that Dark Horse was going to lose the license. Like, I didn't want to admit it to myself, but deep down, I sort of figured it was going to happen that way.
I think as soon as we saw that Disney bought, you know, LucasArts, like, the writing was on the wall.
It's illogical. Like, I really thought it was a dumb idea. Like, I really felt like fiscally they'd be smarter to stay with Dark Horse, but fine. Yeah. And so, but now I'm sort of like, oh, these two issues I have to write are like the end of the run. You know, it's not like the end of the run and some other writer is going to pick it up, you know? So it's sort of like tonally, I have to put a bit of thought into this, you know, and be like, you know, I have two issues left to say what I want to say about Star Wars.
Can I make some suggestions? You need to retcon something seriously wild. Like Boba Fett is actually Luke's father. You know, just got to write it in there, get it permanently on the record. Just totally blow people's minds.
Huh. A menace, Aaron Meyer.
Now, this is my opportunity. I'm going to change history here.
I did really wonder if I was going to have the same level of, like, editorial scrutiny on these last two.
Maybe.
I have had all along, you know.
Uh-huh.
But, no, I think I just got to hit that, like, classic vibe, you know.
Yeah.
Just to go back to the personalities and, you know.
Thanks to Brian Wood for joining us on the couch this week. And thank you to all of you for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy.
And don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local comic shop and subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on our site as always, comicstherapy.com. And until next week, we'll see you later.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Today I'm more confused. Yet I look for the light through the pouring rain. You know that's a game that I hate to lose. And I'm feeling the strain. Ain't it a shame? Oh, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I wanna get lost in your arms.